From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. You hear a lot these days about scientists trying to make science accessible to the public. And you have those who are really good at it, your Neil deGrasse Tysons, your Phil Plates, your Bill Nyes. But before any of those guys were making science fun, you had Ira Flatow. Ira was NPR's first science correspondent, and he pioneered a style that most of us take for granted. When you hear Ira Glass or David Kestenbaum, you're hearing a form of reporting and delivery first field-tested by Ira Flatow. These days, of course, Ira is the host of the popular program Science Friday. The program is coming to Salt Lake City this week to broadcast the show, which is giving us a chance to talk to Ira about science and the process of finding a way to make it make sense to the rest of us. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. One of the ways to learn something about someone is to get their coworkers to talk about them behind their back, which is kind of what we did to find out a little bit about Ira Flatow. Ira and the Science Friday crew is coming to Salt Lake City this week to broadcast the show, which is giving us a chance to talk to Ira about science and reporting science, which, of course, he's done for more than 40 years now. We talked to NPR's Howard Berkus. He told us Ira Flatow pioneered a style of reporting and delivery that most of us listeners really just take for granted. It was a style born out of the very real challenge of trying to make science not just understandable, but interesting and fun. Robert Krowich of the program Radio Lab told us he learned from Ira a writing style that was matter-of-fact and comfortable with its subject. Krowich says in the early days of NPR, radio could be formal and stiff, but he says Ira knew that wasn't going to work with science. He says Ira invited people to listen by acting like he was a neighbor, urgently telling you something you really need to know. Today in the program, Ira Flatow is joining us, and we're taking this opportunity since, of course, the show is going to be broadcasting live from Salt Lake City. We'll give you the details about that as we go along. You can join us. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'd also like to hear from those of you on Facebook and on Twitter. Ira Flatow is, of course, the host of the NPR program Science Friday, which has been on the air for 22 years now. Before that, he served as a science correspondent for NPR. He's won numerous awards for his work, including the Carl Sagan Award for Public Understanding of Science. He's the author of three books, including Present at the Future. And he's joining us today from the studios of NPR in New York City. And Ira Flatow, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Nice to be here. Thanks for those kind words from Robert Krowich and Howard Berkus.
Yeah.
I'll have to get even with them
yeah,
somehow.
Yeah, good. I guess people, do they assume that you are or were a scientist? Do you get that a lot?
Yeah, you know, I don't even play one on the radio. They do. They assume that that's the one of the first questions asked. Besides, you know, what do you have on the show this week?
Yeah.
Is are you a scientist? Do you have a science background? I have an engineering degree, and from SUNY Buffalo, and I spent 4 years studying engineering. I was not very good at it, but I also had a lot of ham in me. I was involved in a lot of high school drama productions, and I was not afraid of speaking my mind or speaking before the public. And so when I was in college studying engineering and not being very good at it, I gravitated to the radio station and decided I could twist some dials on one side of the board there. And they were looking to expand their coverage, news coverage, and were looking to train news reporters. And they had a staff meeting and said, anybody want to be trained? And I looked around and I said, I'll do that. And we started covering anti-war demonstrations and riots and things that finally did occur at SUNY Buffalo. And I was lucky enough to be in the company of Bill Siemering, who was the station manager.
Wow.
Who started All Things Considered and created basically NPR's mission statement. And so I sort of cut my teeth with him.
Yeah. So did you always have an interest in science in the background, or was that something that just kind of came to you eventually?
I was one of these what we call geeky, nerdy people that we're changing actually the conversation to be Benji, and I'll explain that if you're interested.
Sure.
I used to blow things up in the basement and, you know, repair TV sets, take apart washing machines. I wanted to deconstruct and see how everything worked. And then I would build these electronic kits like Heath kits and things like that. And I was always interested in electrical things, and it's sort of still my hobby now. And And so I got – I was always, you know, one of these kids who liked to know how the world worked, and I was always eager to tell people what I knew. And so I – going into radio was – being a yenta, it was a natural thing to do, you know?
Well, that's one thing that Robert Krulwich did tell us about you, is that you like – you still like to build things. I'm trying to imagine what – like, are you still in the basement putting stuff together?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I have a basement. I put stuff together. I've expanded into building. My building now more is biological than electrical. I mean, I'm still one of these first adopters. I buy electronic stuff and try to – I'll hack my iPhone or something, or I'll try to see how to make something better. But I've also gotten into flowers and plants and other things. I raise lots of orchids. I have about 3 dozen orchids on my windowsills around my house.
And, wow.
And they're pretty easy to take care of, and I like to do that. I like to watch things grow. I love the theater. I love baseball. I love drama. So that's why I'm into all kinds of different things. Yeah. There's just so much to be into.
Does science tie all that together in some ways? Because it explains kind of how it works.
Oh, yeah. You know, Richard Feynman said it best. You know, he was a very famous physicist many years ago. And he wrote a book about – it was called The Joy of Knowing. And he said, you know, as a scientist, I can look at this flower. I can look at the petals, and I can look at the beauty, the colors, and I can enjoy it from that perspective as much as you can. But I can enjoy it even more because I can go inside that flower and understand the biology and the chemistry that's going on in the flower and the cell structure and everything else that makes the flower what it is. And that's another layer of enjoyment because I'm interested in science. Mm. So his point was science is everywhere. It's beautiful. It's what makes it – it describes nature. And that's how I look at the world. I'm out there in my driveway looking up at the stars and, you know, in the cold nights with my telescope, my little backyard telescope, or I'm looking for that comet that might be out there. And I don't care if anybody else is interested. I'll try to get my kids interested in it, although, you know, they're not until I force them, and then they enjoy it.
Yeah.
But I want to know how everything works. Yeah. And, you know, and I have a big mouth. I like to talk about it, so – people have to put up with me. They put up with me telling them if they like to hear it or not.
Well, and there's this other part of you that is determined to tell people the truth. There's the story you tell in your book about the real reason planes fly. and you tell the story.
My favorite topic.
Yes. I know it's your favorite topic. You spent a lot of time with it in your book. And
yes.
You talk about this one day in 1989, and you write, this is how you put it in your book. You say, I met a man who would change my life forever. So I want you to set this up for us. I mean, you say in the book you had just finished making this speech to some people at the science conference at the University of Vermont.
And I was talking about why airplanes fly, and I was mouthing the typical stuff that I had heard, that it was because of the Bernoulli principle, which everybody has been told, you know. I'll sum it up very quickly. Air flows over a wing. It flows under a wing faster than it flows on top of the wing, so there's less pressure because Bernoulli principle says there would be less pressure, and it pushes the wing up. Basically, the wing gets sucked up into the air like a soda straw. And I thought that's how it all had happened. And the professor came down to me from when I was done, and he handed me a sheaf of papers, research that he had done that said, it's not, don't explain it from the Bernoulli principle because we really don't, there's no research that shows that's actually how it works. Explain it from Newton's laws, right? Newton has 3 laws of motion, and everything has to conform to those 3 laws. Explain it. The wing makes the air go down, air going down, force goes up. It's like Newton's 3rd law of motion. Like, you know, a rocket ship, you watch a rocket, you see the thrust goes down, the rocket goes up.
Right.
Same thing is happening in the plane. Why did they use the Bernoulli principle? Because after World War II, when people started flying on planes, they wanted to come up with some easy explanation. I mean, Bernoulli is involved in this a little bit, the principle. But as my research was showing, as I wrote about this in the book, a plane would have to take off at 400 miles an hour for there to be enough lift from the Bernoulli principle. And explaining it from Newton's laws is a lot more fun. And if you sit under a helicopter, you feel the wind going down, right? You all see the prop wash, but you can't see it under the wing of an airplane because you can't run that fast. Yeah. So, but if you could, and there are photographers who I include in my book who have taken pictures of airplanes flying through clouds, you can see the clouds parting underneath the airplane as the wind goes down.
You know what was so interesting to me about that story, though? I mean, beyond the fact that you cleared things up, was that you felt so strongly about this. I mean, you talked about this thing changing your life.
Because I was pushing back as much as people were pushing me.
Yeah.
And there is still great debate. If you go on the internet, you'll see this is one of the hottest topics for nerdy physics debate about the Bernoulli principle. And it just does not describe it very well. But I, you know, when people push hard on something that I feel needs to be pushed back on, I will push back on that. And I, you know, that's part of the mission of what I do, and coming from where I started at Buffalo with Bill Siemering, talking about what how he viewed his mission of what we do in public radio.
Mm-hmm. There's this
is to try to get to the truth. You know, we try to get to the truth, and one of the interesting parts about a talk show that Science Friday is, and what Bill had taught me over the years, is that if you let people talk long enough, the truth will come out. You just let them talk, and you will hear the truth. After a while, it'll come out.
It'll come out. There's this bit you did, gosh, more than 30 years ago now. People talk about it all the time, and I've got to mention it. Because I think the people who are just new to NPR will not remember the time 30 years ago when you took Susan Stamberg into this dark closet with a roll of wintergreen lifesavers. This was. Did you realize this was July of 1979? Did you realize it was this far back?
Yeah. I speak everything now in terms of 30 years.
Right. Well, I guess explain how it starts. I mean, there's this letter you get from this woman in Baltimore, and her kids told her this thing.
Yeah, I had the good fortune of co-hosting All Things Considered that week with Susan Stamberg. So about a year before then, I got a letter from a mother in Baltimore, and she wrote me, "Dear Ira, I know you like to look at the science mysteries. Here's one that, please, maybe you can answer for me." What's that? Okay. My kids go into a closet. Now, being a modern mother, I don't want to interfere with what they're doing in there. They go in the closet, and they tell me, "What are you doing?" "Well, nothing, Mom. Not what you think we're doing. We're in the closet chewing on wintergreen lifesavers in the dark because they spark in the dark." And she said, "Well, Ira, can you investigate this? Is this really true?" And I stuck this up on my bulletin board for looking for the right time, timing is everything, the right time to do this piece. And sure enough, here I was with Susan, going to be hosting the show that week. So in the morning meeting, trying to lay out what we were going to do that day, I brought this up and I said, "Let's find out the truth about this thing this week. And let's do that today." And you know what? I'm not even going to show Susan this in advance because I want to see her surprise.
Yeah.
But I have to go research this, right? I have to find out. Maybe I can find out what if this is true or not. And I have like 5 hours before we go on the air to do this. So I called up Lifesavers, and they vehemently denied that there's any such thing happening when you talk. I knew it was onto something because they doth protest too much.
Right.
So I knew I was onto something here, and so I could not get the answer before the end of the day. So at the end of the day, we did go into a closet with a pack of wintergreen lifesavers. I, making sure I didn't want to make an idiot out of myself in advance, went into the bathroom first, shut the lights out, and looked in the mirror. And sure enough, they did spark in the dark.
Yeah.
So I knew I was safe in trying that out. And then so at the end of the program, we were in the closet together. Showing on the light. "You see that, Susan?" "Yeah. Oh, yeah. All right. Wow." I said, "You could do that." And we did it. And she said, "Do you know why that is?" And I said, "You know, I don't know.
Yeah.
But I think by this time tomorrow, we will find out." And sure enough, the phones were ringing off the wall with physics professors and whatever, people who had researched this. And one important phone call before I went on the air that day, our secretary said, "You got to answer this." A woman was on the phone. She said, "Ira, you got to tell everybody, make sure you don't lock yourself in the closet, because I did that. And if my husband hadn't come, you know, all things considered, on a drive time, if he hadn't come home in a driveway, we would have suffocated." So I said, "Do it in the bathroom first,
right.
So you can get yourself and unlock the door." And that was the most popular, more male in the next 10 years of all things considered than any other thing that we did.
Yeah, people are still talking about it.
They are.
You went to Antarctica in 1979. And this is interesting because you've talked about that experience. I mean, there's this – for those who have been around long enough, have seen the picture of Ira Flatow interviewing the three or four penguins there from Antarctica. It kind of became this iconic picture.
Catherine Boughton deserves credit.
Oh, is that right? Good.
She took it, yes.
I think – but you've talked about how it changed your life.
Yes.
That experience.
Changed my life in many ways. First of all, it was the most gorgeous place I'd ever been to. It was awe-inspiring and very deadly at the same time.
Yeah.
Here I was with 14,000-foot mountains with ice that goes up to the top 2,000 feet of them. And it was absolutely gorgeous blue ice and environment. But at the same time, if I made a mistake out there in that cold, I was done. I learned that nature is unforgiving. Mm. It doesn't care about you. It doesn't. You have to care about yourself enough to be, you know, to be not making those mistakes. And even to this day, I carry so much extra clothing around in my car that my kids still laugh at me 30 years later, thinking, you think you're still at the South Pole? You're not, Dad. You know, I'm still taking my clothing with me because I don't want to make those two mistakes. You're allowed to make one mistake. You're allowed to be caught in a blizzard out there. And if you have your clothes, you're saved. But if you have two mistakes, you're not, you know. It's like driving your car. You're allowed to make a mistake of going through the red light. But if someone else made the second mistake of going through the intersection at the same time, you're toast.
Yeah.
So make sure you don't get those two mistakes put together at the same time. So it changed my life in many, many ways.
Yeah. What was the pitch that you made to NPR 22 years ago or whatever it was for Science Friday? Was it a particular pitch?
Yeah, I had. I went to my bosses at NPR, and I said, you know, talk radio is there's this thing called talk radio. It's going to be very popular. There's a guy named Limbaugh and somebody else are out there. They're doing these talk radio things. We public radio should have some, and NPR should have some also. And I have an idea for a science show that I'd like to do every Thursday. Thursday? Yeah, because that's when the press releases or embargoes are up. We're allowed to talk about what's going to be in the news. We get to see it earlier in the week. Mm. So they said, well, you know, we can't convince public radio people. They don't have these shows, and how are we going to talk them into it? And who are you going to get for the other 4 days? Mm. I said, well, I'll line up people for the other 4 days. I'll ask Susan Stamberg and maybe Diane Rehm and these other people. We can do a national talk show. I said, okay, you go away and do that, and I'll think about this. And Saddam Hussein actually bailed us out because 1990 was the first Gulf War, and NPR did a daily talk show about what happened. And the public radio network liked that. And it was a short war, if you recall. But they wanted to have another talk show. Yeah. And I raised my hand. I said, remember that Science Thursday idea? They said, okay, we'll give it to you on Friday. And we'll fill in the other 4 days of the week. And Friday has a little better lilt to it, I think, anyhow.
And so, Science Thursday seems weird.
Yeah, it's a little hard. So we're, you know, we're in our 22nd year. We're going to be here for 22 more years. So.
Mm. How do you describe your interviewing technique? I mean, and how does it work? I mean, do you do a lot of deep research, or are you trying to hold something back so you can look for that genuine sense of surprise that you seem to like?
I sound good because I have a great staff.
Yeah,
my staff does most of the homework. You know, I've gathered a lot of information. It's a inch deep and a mile wide over the years, but my staff really does most of the homework and deserves most of the credit. I'm sort of good at the showmanship part on the other end of the microphone. You know, I guess my gift, if I have one, is I'm not afraid to talk to people. I'm not afraid to ask a question, no matter who that person is, whether it's a 5-time Nobel Prize winner or some kid in high school. I'll ask them the same question, and you know, and they'll give me answers. And if I don't like the answer, or if I think I know what the real answer is or close to it, I'll ask it again, and I'll ask it a third time in different ways, and eventually we will try to get as you know, talk about it enough, and you'll get to the truth. But it's not being afraid to show your enthusiasm for a topic.
Yeah.
If we talk about dark energy or dark matter, the fact that we don't know what 96% of the universe is made out of, you don't have to make that stuff up. That's the truth, and that is exciting stuff.
Mm.
And radio is about the art, I don't have to tell you this, is about the art of communicating one-on-one. I have to make that person on the other end of the radio or the podcast or whatever it is think that we're having a conversation just the two of us in that room or car or wherever we are. And that's not hard to do because that's how I think we should all be talking,
yeah.
How we should all be conversing anyhow.
There's a great story you tell which kind of gets at this myth that you write about, that this idea that science knows everything. And there's this woman who had written in – you had these two scientists on the program who were arguing, and I think they're probably still arguing about this, is whether or not this giant asteroid had killed off the dinosaurs.
Right, right.
And the woman said something to the effect of, isn't that what science is for? Why are these two arguing? You know, science –
doesn't science know something?
Yeah, right.
Yes. Everybody thinks there's a giant book called science. It's a giant – think of those big dictionaries. You open that book and – there it is. What we know is right there in that book. Well, science is a process. It's a method. It's a method of observing, having an idea, observing, conducting some experiments to test out your idea, and then seeing if your idea holds up to what you observe. It's basically, it's a system of discovery, of system of testing things out. So depending on when who the scientist is and the time and place, whatever you know at that moment is just a snapshot. It's going to move. Maybe a year later you know something more. Maybe we know a few more planets that exist that we didn't know the year before. Maybe our idea of the universe changes because we know something more about it. Maybe we know something different about how diabetes works than we knew before then. So when we say science knows something, it really only knows through this process, and it's just a little bit of what we know at the moment. And that could change.
Mm. There's this great story you tell about I think I heard this actually, Jane Goodall. You had Jane Goodall on the program. And she really stunned you, it seems like anyway, completely surprised you. I mean, you had asked her if there were any it's a great question. Are there any undiscovered large ape species out there? What were you expecting her to say, Ira? Do you know?
You know what? It wasn't even my question. Huh. I had interviewed her for about 45. We were running out of time. She was so great to talk to.
Yeah.
And I figured I've got to get a phone call in before we end. And a guy on the other end of the line says exactly what you said. Dr. Goodall, are there any other apes out there that we haven't discovered yet? And she said, can't do Jane's accent. She said, of course there are, and I think they do exist. And he said, I do too. Do you think we're going to discover them? And she says, I think that we will. And I said, time out. I'm the only one in the room that doesn't know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
But I have an idea. Are you really talking about the abominable snowman, Yeti, Sasquatch, that you think that it exists? She said, yes, I think it exists, and I think we now have, some fur from the ape, and we have viable DNA at the bottom. Maybe we can do a DNA analysis. And just at that time, we ran out of time talking about it. I said, well, I shouldn't have saved it to the last 2 minutes. But in fairness to her, she's been on many times since then,
yeah.
And we have talked about it, and she still does agree.
Well, what I think is interesting about this is that, we've done programs that deal with this. You had the same guy we had on, Jeff Meldrum, interesting professor from Idaho's, firm believer that there is some undiscovered species out there. But this is such a taboo in the world of science. How do you take that on? The idea of introducing the fact that there is someone who believes, that there are people like Jane Goodall who believe there's something out there, and science who, they demand evidence and they're skeptical.
Yes.
I mean, how do you balance all of that?
Well, science is self-correcting.
Yeah.
In other words, you can bring up an idea anytime, but it has to have legs. It has to be testable for it to be true. In other words, let's take something people have been talking about for years, string theory.
Yeah.
Now, string theory is over 30 years old. They've been talking about string theory for ages. Yet, there are no experiments that you can do to actually test out string theory because you need a collider as big as the universe.
Yeah.
It takes those kinds of energies. So after a while, what science says, if you really can't test something out, even though you have a theory for it, it sounds viable, something with 11 dimensions and tiny little things rolled up, blah, 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 even though it mathematically is sound, if you can't really test it out after a while, we have to let it go. You let it go and to try to do something else because after a while, just believing in it becomes religion. And science is not religion. Science is something that has to be tested out and has to be. So you can come up with any theory that you want to, cold fusion, whatever you'd like to come up. If you can't make a prediction, and this is to be a valid theory in science, people don't really understand this, to be a valid theory in science, your idea has to be predictable so that we can make an experiment that sees if that prediction comes true. That's why even relativity, Einstein's theories, are still being tested.
Yeah.
You know, 100 years later, they're still doing tests on those theories because they're so hard to observe. But they, you know. And it's the same thing with quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics has been called one of the most successful theories ever made. And as as Richard Feynman once said, among other scientists, yet it's so unbelievable and it's so incredible, it's true, that if any scientist ever tells you why it's true, they're lying because they don't know. But it's still testable. Makes no sense, but it's still testable. And so it's true, and it holds up to the scientific thesis. So I have no trouble with bringing up we used to talk about cold fusion a lot in the early days when it was on. And people used to say to me, why are you talking about that? And I used to get research papers in all the time. And I wanted to, you know, I thought it deserved, for example, to be talked about. And, you know, and until there were no more tests that were being done that could make successful predictions, and we've given it up. I still get 100 papers on it every once in a while. And a lot of people are working on it. And some of those papers used to come from the U.S. Navy. So we know who's working and still working. Maybe not so much anymore. But it's fun. You know, it's fun. It's fun to make people think. Make people think and consider new ideas.
Ira Flatow is with us. He's host, of course, of NPR's Science Friday. He and the Science Friday crew, they're coming here to Salt Lake City for a live broadcast of the show on Friday. It's going to happen at the Grand Theater on the campus of the Salt Lake Community College during the show's regular time slot, of course, noon to 2. Tickets for the event, we should say, are sold out, but more may be made available this week. So go to our website for the details, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, Ira Flatow is among our guests. You know him, of course, as the host of the popular program Science Friday. Ira's been covering science for more than 40 years. He was NPR's first science correspondent. Science Friday crew is coming to Salt Lake City to do the show this week, which is giving us a chance to talk to Ira Flatow. And I guess, you know, you raised this question before, this idea of religion, and you tell the story in your book about moderating a panel discussion at the Tribeca Film Festival in New York. And I guess the idea was we're, you know, bridging science and the arts. And on this panel was the great Dr. James Watson, of course, co-discoverer of the structure of the DNA molecule. And this, you talk about how this woman gets up and she asks what it seems to me like a pretty reasonable question. She asks, did his religious beliefs influence his work? Which seems, again, a pretty legitimate question, but he hated that question and really went off on her. It seems to kind of beat her to a pulp.
Yeah, he did. And I thought it was quite unnecessary because I don't think – you know, there have been people since then who are very very rabid atheists, I think. You know, they just don't take any prisoners with people who might believe in any sort of organized religion. They may be spiritual themselves, but they really have taken upon themselves to be the judge and jury of these people. And I don't think that has any place in the kind of science reporting that we do. There are other scientists. There are scientists who are able to put the I'm thinking of Francis Collins right now. He's able to put his religious views in one box, his scientific views in another box. And when he does his science, he doesn't let his religious views influence his science. I have interviewed James Watson many times since then, and he basically held to the same Same views, although he's mellowed a little bit more mm-hmm. as he's gotten older. I've interviewed him 10 years ago when we talked about the anniversary of the DNA molecule. And I interviewed him just a few weeks ago, and I asked him basically the same questions. And he's gotten a little more mellow as he's gotten older.
Right.
That's the word he uses, too.
Is that the word? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I think he's gotten mellowed out a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is better for the radio. Probably, and better for Science Friday, right?
It's very easy to create a food fight. Yeah. And that's basically what cable television is all about, is creating a food fight. You try to find polarized viewpoints and let them sit out there and slug it out, because a lot of what is on in the news now, these shows are owned by the entertainment business. Yeah. They're all owned by the entertainment people, so they want to create entertaining television or radio. And that's not what we're about. We want to do entertaining radio. We believe science intrinsically is entertaining. You just tell people about science, and they just, wow. People love science. People say, how do you get people interested in science? We don't have to.
Yeah.
They love science. They love to talk about it, and we'll take as much as we can give them. So we don't have to we don't have to polarize it. It's interesting itself.
Yeah. I don't have a lot more time with you, so I wanted to get to this question mm-hmm. about Talk of the Nation, which, as most people know by now, is going away shortly. Science Friday's always been independent of Talk of the Nation.
Yes.
But how do you figure this is going to change your program, if at all?
We're not seeing any radical changes to our program. We don't envision doing anything radical, because we have 2 million listeners and podcasters a week. Why should we change something that's working? We may actually add more science rather than to do less. We may actually add more podcasts to our program. We might think of a weekend version of Science Friday. We're thinking about all these other things. We're getting like 1,100 people coming out to see us on Friday there in Salt Lake.
Yeah.
People love Science Friday. Why should we want to tamper with something that is really popular? So we have been independent for 22 years. We're independent. We're produced by the Science Friday Initiative, an independent nonprofit organization. So we can control, hopefully, as much as our own destiny as possible. And we love what we're doing, and we'll try to do it for another 22 years or longer.
What's the science that is exciting you right now? Or do you feel like we're on the cusp? Is there something in – I mean, there's so much, of course. But is there something in particular that really gets you?
Well, I touched on it before. I love the idea that given dark energy and dark matter, we don't know what 96% of the universe is made out of. Everything you see with your eyes and everything that's bright in the sky or your tabletop or whatever, it's only 4% of the universe. 96% of the universe is dark. It's either this spooky dark energy that we have no idea what it is, or it's this dark matter that holds galaxies together. So even though we're in the 21st century, we think we're so smart, we don't know what 96% of it is made out of. I also think that, genetic engineering and stem cells and things like that hold great promise. And I think we're going to see those breakthroughs coming real soon now.
All of those things, though, raise these ethical questions and really seem to kind of challenge our view of ourselves.
Yes.
How do you figure we're going to respond to all of that?
That's what we view as our mission. Our mission is to tell people about this, because they actually make the decisions about where the money is being spent. Basic research comes from the government. Companies don't do a lot of basic research. Most of it comes from the U.S. government. So their budgets decide where that's going to be done. And so I feel that we have to talk about these issues, make them public, bring them to the fore, and give them as much exposure as we can. This week, the Supreme Court is going to talk about who owns your genetic code.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you want to know whether you have a right to it? If a company wants to do your genome, human genome, and decipher your genome for you, does it only that company have the right to do it, and you can't get a second opinion? If someone has patented that genetic code, they can't get a second opinion. Mm. The Supreme Court is going to rule on things like that, and these are all important issues that people have to know about.
Well, we're going to have Flora Lichtman on the program here in a moment. This gives you a chance to talk behind her back. Talk about – I'm interested in what Flora's sort of – she's added another dimension to Science Friday, which I think has been nice.
Flora is a treasure on Science Friday. Flora is one of the few natural radio people you come across who's put her in front of a microphone. She's a natural at doing the radio. Not only that, but she is doubly talented, as she is one of the most creative video people I've ever seen. She can take video stuff, add her own little twist to it, graphics, sort of Monty Python it up a little bit, and it is just beautiful and interesting stuff to watch. So we're very, very happy to have Flora. And you know, she's doing a little more of on-the-air stuff now. She's natural at radio. We give her more time.
Yeah, good for you. Ira Flatow, the host of NPR Science Friday. He and the Science Friday crew, as I mentioned, they're here in Salt Lake City this Friday for a live broadcast at the Grand Theater. It's from noon to 2. Tickets for the event, I mentioned already, are sold out, but there may be some available this week. That's not a tease. I think that's actually possible. So just go to our website for the details, radiowest.kuer.org. Ira Flatow, thank you so much for the time.
You're very welcome, Doug. Thank you.
And we're going to take a break. We're back with Flora Lichtman after a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Ira Flatow and the Science Friday crew is coming to Salt Lake City this Friday to do a live broadcast of the program at the Grand Theater on the campus of the Salt Lake Community College. It's giving us an opportunity to talk earlier with Ira and about Science Friday. We have with us now on the program Flora Lichtman. She, of course, is a correspondent, the managing video editor at Science Friday. Before joining the program, she worked in Italy studying the effects of noise on marine mammals. And Flora Lichtman, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So let's start there, the effects of noise on marine mammals. So I asked Ira if he was a scientist. Clearly you are, right, or were?
No, I wouldn't go that far.
Really?
I really wasn't. I was like a deckhand on board an oceanographic vessel. But the only thing you needed to be able to do for that job was stand on the top of the ship for hours on end and look through binoculars on the horizon for whales. I got really lucky. I had sort of a great summer job that led to that gig in Italy. But that's actually how I learned about Science Friday, was when I was living there.
So how do you describe your interest in science, your affection for science, I guess?
I'm an enthusiastic observer.
Yeah.
I've always been really interested in the natural world. I was one of those kids that always was building terrariums and trying to catch any animal that was too slow to escape me. And I think that that turned into my interest today. But now Science Friday has really exposed me to all these other fields of science, realms of science that I never knew I was interested in.
Yeah.
So now I love space and space topics. And as a kid, that wasn't something that was really right up my alley at all. So that's sort of been one of the perks of the job, is just every week we get to learn something new. I mean, what a great job.
Yeah. How describe what it is that you were asked to do with the I guess it's – is it fair to say, Flora, take Science Friday and sort of translate what we do on the radio onto the web? Is that –
I think that's pretty fair. I started as an intern, and Ira, you know, he mentioned in his interview that that Science Friday is an early adopter, and that is definitely true. So Science Friday was podcasting, was one of the very first outlets to podcast, and when I came on as an intern, Ira was always thinking of ways that we might get out on the web and try new things out on the web. We really, I think appropriately, we try to experiment on Science Friday. And so that's what I was hired to do. And when we first started, we tried a lot of different things, little news stories. And eventually Ira was like, well, why don't we try video? And I had never done video before, but I'd done a little photography. Hmm. And I ended up loving it. Although I look back in my early videos and I'm just so grateful that I wasn't fired. I mean, I feel like I've gotten a lot better.
Well, how is it you figure, because I have to say, you've become such a fixture for the program, and the videos have become such a fixture for the program. How do you explain that? Just that we, and I'm wondering if you're appealing to, do you think, a younger audience as well?
I think I am appealing to a younger audience, because the only sort of real fan mail I get are from people under the age of 10.
Yeah.
And And I love that. I used to be embarrassed by this because when I'm making the videos, I really am making them for myself, what I think is interesting, and I'm presenting them in a way that I think is funny. I'm 30, so when you have an 8-year-old tell you that you're really hitting him or her on his level, I at first thought this was sort of embarrassing, but now I'm really proud of this. I feel like if it can appeal to me and to an 8-year-old, that's great. So I think we do sort of get a younger audience. I've heard a lot of teachers like to use them in the classroom. I was at a high school this weekend giving a talk, and mm-hmm. I heard from the chemistry teacher that he loves to use them in his high school chemistry class. So that was gratifying. And I think they slowly became a fixture on the show. You know, I started 7 or 8 years ago.
Yeah.
So we've been doing this for kind of a long time. And then we started promoting them on the air in our little Pick of the Week segment.
Mm-hmm.
And I think over time, people have now come to expect them. But it certainly didn't happen overnight. And there was a lot of sort of trial and error and experimenting with tone and style until we figured out a way to translate the vibe mm-hmm. of Science Friday on the air to Science Friday on the web.
You know, one of my favorites was, and it really wasn't just the way you had presented it, although it's interesting. Do you remember that octopus who basically disappears when...
Like I'll never forget that octopus.
That was unbelievable. I have to say it was one of my favorite things, and it was just extraordinary, amazing.
And that's the kind of science video that you love to get. So I can't take the credit for that footage. That was Roger Hanlon, who's a marine biologist at the Marine Biological Labs at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, Woods Hole. And I saw this footage online, and it was sort of buried away in science land. It hadn't really made it, I don't think, to popular culture yet, but that seemed wrong because it was incredible. And I remember when I called him, I asked him, you know, did you know when you captured that piece of footage that you had something special?
Yeah.
And he said that actually he was following this octopus and he saw that happen. And then he had popped up to the surface because he was scuba diving and he started screaming like a maniac.
Yeah.
And everyone on the crew thought he was having a dive accident, that there was this emergency going on. And it was just that he had had this sort of eureka moment, as he called it, underwater. And I think those are the kind of stories that just make my job so easy and so fun. You know, you can watch that, and I know many, many times over, and it's just astounding.
Yeah, me too. I love that one. What do you figure you've learned about the audience over the time? I mean, and this is the basic question. What it is we want, you know, what it is the audience is looking for, what they want, and, you know, in its most basic terms, do you think?
I think people want to be surprised, yeah. And the octopus video does that. But one thing that I've learned recently that has surprised me and I found really heartening, and I don't know if this is public radio listeners specifically or people in general, but even if I do a really mind-bending video, even if it's really hard to grasp, but it just makes you think in a deep way, people will gravitate towards it. So let me give you an example.
Yeah.
A couple weeks ago, we did a video about how you tie water in a knot. And this jumped out at me because I thought, this is really weird. What? You can tie water in a knot? And the amazing thing is that our listeners and our viewers on our website also really liked it. It was a really popular video, even though it was hard to understand, it was hard to explain, they still came and watched it and sent it to their friends because it got pretty high traffic. So that's really gratifying. It makes me think, you know, even if it's hard, we can tell that kind of story. And I don't think you see that everywhere in the news.
So it's like, I think you've described it as kind of like you have a recipe for the videos that you create, and like there's a key ingredient. What's the key ingredient?
Oh, there are a few.
Yeah.
I think people like people. And so one of the things that we've tried, and we do this on the show too, you can tell Ira, when he talks to people, he's trying to also give you a sense of who they are, their personality. It's not just about sort of conveying information. It's about humanizing these topics as well. And so one of the things that I try to do in the videos is get across the personality of the scientists.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I feel like scientists are often portrayed, even in popular scientific portrayals, as sort of white lab coat people or people who are really nerdy and very dry and don't have a sense of the, you know, the larger world. And I have not found that to be true. And so that's one of my personal ingredients. And we do series that are devoted to that, sort of exposing the personality of great scientists and great thinkers. So that's one thing. The other, another ingredient for videos that I think videos have sort of a special way of communicating science, because more and more researchers are using video in the course of their experiments through high-speed video or infrared video or time-lapse or whatever it is. You know, cameras are becoming cheaper and easier to use, and now everyone's carrying a camera in their pocket anyway.
Yeah.
And so people can actually participate in the joy of discovery the way that, you know, you can show people that octopus footage and recreate that eureka moment for people in a way that it's very hard to do with other non-visual scientific data. So if you showed people an Excel chart of statistical data and said, yeah, if you just put a regression on this, oh, my God, your mind would be blown. You know, it's really hard. It's really hard to get a good reaction. But with scientific data that is video, you're asking people to use tools they have, their eyes and their brain, to decode it. And that's usually what researchers do, too. So you can really walk people through the experiment. And I feel like videos that take advantage of that are often more successful than ones that don't.
You have this presentation that you give where you talk about the challenges of science journalism. Are you okay if I play a little clip from it?
Sure.
I mean, this, because I want to get you to talk about it, because you talk about how you try to build the sense of mystery into your videos. And you said there are always these layers and layers and layers of questions that always come in science. It's not a long clip. It's just a brief thing. But I wanted to play it and then have you talk about it, if it's okay.
Great.
Bicycles are beautiful, like the stars are beautiful. And one likes to stare at the stars and wonder how they work. And we like to stare at bicycles and wonder how they work.
You know, when you stare at a flame, you kind of can't help but wonder, what the heck is that thing?
The different ways of getting water in, it's kind of fascinating.
And anytime I look at any insect, it's doing something that I couldn't even begin to design a robot or a machine to do. And the insect is doing it faster, easier, more precisely, and more accurately than I can imagine.
What's the thing that appeals to you about that? This idea that, again, that there's always a question and always a mystery and always another question?
I love those clips. And the third one, there's always there's it's kind of interesting how we get water in. There's a picture of a dog lapping, and apparently scientists have studied this too. So the thing that I love about science and the videos that I get to do is that they're often about everyday things that scientists look around them and say, how does that bicycle do that? I'm going to go look into it and find out. And the idea that you can actually get paid to do that is so inspiring and heartening to me that I really like that. And you're right. You know, I think the funny thing is about with science is that there's never any end to the mystery. So, you know, every time I'm at the end of an interview, it's not like the person's like, well, I published it in Science and that's it. No more mysteries here. I'm just going to pack my bags and go home. No, of course not. It's always like, well, now all these new questions have popped up. So you just dig a little bit. You drill down a little farther with every sort of answer you get. And that's nice, too. You know, I know that we'll never run out of work at Science Friday.
You know, it's one thing that Ira has talked about is, you know, he talks about how science is supposed to be sexy, and it can be, and you talk about how it can be appetizing. But he also talks about how Americans, you know, significant numbers of Americans don't really get things. Like he talks about how, I'm not sure if this is still the figure, but something like 40% of Americans think that humans were around when dinosaurs were around, and like 53% don't know that the Earth goes around the sun in 365 days. And I'm wondering if you think that's changing at all, if you think we're becoming more aware of basic principles of science.
You know, I don't know if we are. That's certainly part of, I think, why we do what we do at Science Friday is that we think it's important to be able to share the truth. But I don't have a good sense of whether that's changing or not. Do you have any sense of that?
You know, I think we keep talking about it, and I think that I do, actually. I have a sense that, and I think people are, I mean, the big hang-up is a lot of the times it's politics, and sometimes it's your kind of sense of the universe, you know, whether you believe in God or not. And I think that's kind of an obstacle sometimes. But I think humans we're really adaptive as a species. And so the more we learn, the more we can adapt, whether that's good or not, the things that we actually do believe into our worldview. And I just think, I don't know, my sense is that, things are kind of shifting and changing. I think the fact that people are liking the videos, you know, you're finding a younger generation that's finding the thing that's more intuitive to them. Like, you know, a lot of us older guys, you know, we came to Science Friday from the old sort of radio model. But, you know, Flora, you're bringing in another generation, and I think that's a good thing, obviously.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think you're right in the sense that people are forced to confront science, I think maybe more than in the past, in the sense that all of these new scientific advancements have created new questions that I think people have to consider. And technology clearly has changed the way some people interact with science because, you know, people can unlock their iPhone and navigate the web and hack into music and illegally download it or whatever else. But you get the sense that in that way, anyway, science is becoming part of people's everyday lives, maybe in a new way.
That's Flora Lichtman.
I don't know.
Yeah, good answer. And way to turn that around on me and ask me a question. Really science journalist of you. Absolutely great. Flora Lichtman, correspondent, managing video editor at Science Friday. She joined us from NPR New York. So, Flora, thank you very much for the time.
Well, thank you for having me.
The Science Friday crew is going to be here on Friday, of course, for a live broadcast of the show at the Grand Theater on the campus of the Salt Lake Community College. During that show's regular time slot, noon to 2, tickets for the event are sold out, but more may be available. Go to our website to check out the details on that, radiowest.kuer.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Lane Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.